two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, premieres on April 16th. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
One of my many counterparts in the 2020 presidential primary was a Democratic socialist from Vermont who you may be familiar with, Senator Bernie Sanders.
We have a government that ignores the needs of working people, yet works overtime for wealthy campaign contributors and the 1%.
You cannot beat Trump with the same old kind of politics.
The only way we transform America is when millions of people together stand up and fight back.
After sharing the campaign trail for nearly a year, one thing became increasingly clear. Bernie had a consistent message. He's been fighting for social and economic justice since his days as a college activist, a fight that he has sustained in his current role in the Senate. With the campaign trail far behind us and Joe Biden set to become the 46th president in just a few weeks, Senator Sanders and I sat down to talk about the challenges facing our country in 2021 and beyond, and what looking a little deeper into the election results can tell us about what needs to be done.
Now, the very good news is that Joe Biden got 80 million votes. That was 11 million more votes than Hillary Clinton received. That's extraordinary. Bad news is that after 4 years of Donald Trump, Trump received 72 million, 8 million more votes than he got last time.
Yeah.
I think that's an issue we have got to think long and hard about.
This is Our America. I'm your host, Julian Castro.
I grew up in a, you know, lower income home. I lived in what in New York City was called rent control. And that was a program by which working class, lower income families couldn't pay more than a certain percentage of their income. And that was a godsend to us because we didn't have much money. But the role that money played in my family, or lack of money played, the kind of tension that it created between my parents, the arguments that there would be taking place. Can we do this? Can we afford to do this? My mother wanted to do something. My father didn't want to do it. You know, money, money, money. You know, and I understood I was, we were not the only family in that position. So what does it mean to be a family in America, of which there are tens of millions, who today are struggling to put food on the table to pay their rent? So that I learned. And that's a lesson that I never forgot. And the second lesson that I learned is I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. And as a little boy, having been born in 1941, I can remember, you know, learning about the Holocaust and knowing my father's family was wiped out by Hitler. And to ask, how could that be? How could that be? How could people do such horrible things to other human beings? So I learned at a very young age, before, you know, emotionally, before I did intellectually, what so-called white nationalism was about. A group of people who thought they were superior to other people, and that leads you to the horrendous conclusion that Nazism led to 50 million people dead. So, you know, those were the two, I think, pervasive influences in my political life.
And you became active when you were a student at the University of Chicago. Why did you decide to go into politics in the first place? You know, like, what was the leap that you made to actually jump in and run for office?
Well, my electoral life is very different than I think anybody else in the United States Senate. I mean, I got involved in the civil rights movement when I was a student at the University of Chicago, when in this great bastion of liberal thought, one of the great universities in America. Well, guess what? Back in the 60s, University of Chicago owned segregated housing. How's that? And what we did is we sent a white couple out to the university housing system there and said, you know, we'd like to look to for an apartment. And the guy there was, oh, well, we got three or four apartments here that might serve your needs. And then an hour later, we sent a black couple out. Oh, we're sorry, there's just nothing available. You know, so they were running a segregated housing system. And we dealt with that with some success, I think. But when I came to Vermont and in the early 70s, I got involved in a third party called the Liberty Union Party, which was dealing with economic issues and the war in Vietnam at that point, opposition to the war and dealing with the problems of working class families. And I ran for office four times on a third party. And really, on the first time I ran, I got 2% of the vote.
Which is not uncommon, not uncommon for a third party, right?
Exactly. And I ran the second time. I ran for a Senate the first time. I ran for governor. The second time, I got 1% of the vote, heading the wrong direction. And I ran a few more times, and then I kind of stopped. And then, you know, 7 years after that, I got talked into running for mayor, and I won by 10 votes. So that's my political history.
Third-party politics are something I'm personally familiar with. When my mother saw a gap in policies that addressed the concerns of Mexican Americans in Texas in the 70s, she joined and eventually played a leadership role in a third party called La Raza Unida. She was pushing the establishment to become more progressive, not unlike Senator Sanders has done. Bernie's humble beginnings as mayor of Burlington, Vermont, served as a launchpad for a political career in Congress and eventually the Senate. Over the years, he's been a vocal proponent of universal health care and increased taxes on the wealthiest Americans. And he's gathered a groundswell of progressive momentum by spotlighting issues of income inequality.
If you asked somebody 10 years ago whether Bernie Sanders in the year 2020 would have become the phenomenon that you became politically, people would have probably said, what are you talking about? You know, like, no, that's not going to happen. That couldn't happen. Can you talk to me about initially deciding to run for president in 2015? What did you see that convinced you that that was the time to do it?
So what do we have, 3 or 4 hours to discuss this?
Yeah.
You know, I have always felt, Julian, going way, way, way back, that where people were at, where ordinary people, working people were at, was in a different place than where their political leaders were.
Mm.
That goes way back to when I know I'm talking to a fellow mayor here, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And back in 2015, when Hillary Clinton had been anointed as the Democratic candidate by the establishment and everybody else, it occurred to me that, you know, maybe it would be a good idea to have a voice out there that spoke to where the working families of this country were at, the pain that they were experiencing, spoke to the young people, spoke to the African-American community, the Latino community, raised issues that were not coming from the political establishment. And I thought it would just be an important idea for there to be a progressive voice out there raising those issues and bringing people together. And it turned out that the campaign had a lot more resonance and ended up with a lot more support in 2016 and in 2020 than people, the establishment people, the media, thought possible. And the truth is, what I believe then and what I believe now, Julian, is that there is a lot of pain out there. People want real change in this country. And it turns out that when you start talking truth to power, people start nodding their heads. That's about it. I'm sure you've had that same experience.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think that you did a fantastic job in both of your runs in 2016 and 2020 in speaking very plainly and speaking truth to power and then connecting that with the concerns that exist in the everyday lives of people around the country. Right. And the thing that I would hear about you from regular voters was, hey, he's been consistent. We know what he believes. And all of us as candidates, right? You're looking at the other candidates. I mean, not only did I listen to what you were saying in 2020, 2016, but we went back and looked at what you said in 1995 and 1985, and you have been consistent on these issues. You know, it made me feel like the country has been ripening to your message because inequality has been growing bigger and bigger, and the pain that you talked about, the way people are feeling it, even folks who used to consider themselves solidly middle class, they feel it more now.
Leon, and I think what I'm proud of is simply raising issues that people, you know, were thinking about a little bit, but nobody out there on the national stage was talking about it all that much. I mean, you got 50 people in America today who own more wealth than the bottom half of American society. All right, folks, do you think that that's right? People don't think it's right. We pay 10 times more for certain prescription drugs than people in Mexico, Canada, or in Europe pay. Hey, raise your hand if you think that makes a lot of sense. And then you got to connect the dots. Why is that? What about the power of the healthcare industry and the drug companies under Democratic and Republican rule? Why do they have so much power? How come we are the only major country on earth not to guarantee healthcare to all people? Gee, that's a pretty simple question. And yet we're spending twice as much per capita on healthcare. And when you raise that issue, people start thinking about it. Well, why is that? What does this have to do with a corrupt political system? What does it have to do with the enormous power of lobbyists from the healthcare industry? And that takes you to super PACs, right? And it takes you to the power of the billionaire class. Look, we just came through an election. You got, I imagine, hundreds of billionaires contributing God knows how much money on both sides of the aisle. How many people out there think that that makes sense? All right, there are people in Texas, though, correct me if I'm wrong, Julian, who are making $9 an hour right now. Is that right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. How do you live on $9 an hour?
Yeah, you can't.
Yeah. Okay. And there are millions of people. So when you said, I said 5 years ago, raise that minimum wage to $15 an hour. Oh, Bernie, that's such a radical idea. Well, that's not what working people are making $9 an hour thought. They thought it was a pretty good idea. And now it's kind of mainstream. You got 500,000 people who are homeless. My God, I was out in California during the campaign. You were out to California, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Richest country on earth. You got veterans. 500,000 people sleeping out on the streets. You got half of our people living paycheck to paycheck in the richest country on earth. All right? So I start off with that proposition, and you're right. That's kind of the proposition I've started off with a long, long time ago. Those are the problems, and then we can argue about how we address them. All right, but at least acknowledge the reality and at least acknowledge the incredible power that the 1% and large corporations have over the economic and political life of America.
For Senator Sanders, the issues are clear. And even though he's not headed to the Oval Office in January, he has some ideas about what should be at the top of the next commander-in-chief's to-do list. What do you think that Joe Biden needs to do right away when he takes office for the country?
I think what the people are wanting now is a president who says, you know what, look, I am there on your side. I understand the power of the wealthy and the large corporations. I understand that you are in pain. And together, in a very bold way, we're going to start addressing these issues in a bold, bold way. Above and beyond dealing with COVID, which obviously is an enormous issue, dealing with climate change, dealing with immigration reform, dealing with systemic racism, dealing with the economy, I hope, and I'm not sure that this is going to be the case, but I would hope that the Biden people and Joe himself understands that we cannot go back to doing politics in the same old way. And if it means having to take on powerful special interests, well, you know what? We're going to take on powerful special interests because the times cry out for us to do this. And let me just say this, Julian, and you can tell me if you think I'm crazy on this one, but I want everyone to think about how after 4 years, people knew who Donald Trump was, right?
Exactly, yeah.
8 million people more voted for him than in 2016, and he did very well in working class areas, white working class areas all over this country, and in many areas, he did even better than he did in 2016. This is what I worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Because the next time somebody runs on a Trump-like program, he won't be crazy like Trump is, undisciplined like Trump is. You'll have somebody smarter and more disciplined, and we can end up with authoritarianism. Now, I throw that out, but I want your review. Am I crazy?
I mean, I think you're right. Look, it's frightening. You know, it really is frightening. I mean, I think we have to understand, well, why? And then how do you address the concerns, legitimate concerns, right? There's some people that are voting for reasons that you're never going to get to them, but there are people that are voting for some legitimate concerns that they have. And I think, you know, and many people have pointed this out, that a lot of what you were putting out there was resonating with people on a different level on economic policy, on the kinds of investments they think would help their everyday lives. And so, I mean, if you could dream up this scenario for the first 100 days or first year of the Biden-Harris administration, yeah, what would your top priorities be?
I'm going to answer that, Julian, but I want to throw it back to you. You don't mind me interviewing you?
No,
right?
Go ahead.
All right, because I respect your opinion on this one.
Coming up, Bernie flips the script and asked me some tough questions about how to reach those Trump voters.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
I got a woman in my office who grew up in rural Iowa. And I got another guy who grew up in rural Vermont, you know, and I talked to them. Grew up as kids. And I said, do you think your neighbors, the people you grew up with, many of whom voted for Trump, do you think that they are terrible, awful, horrible people? And the answer is no. Some of them, as you indicated, some of them are racist and sexist of the worst kind. But, you know, I personally don't believe that is all of the, because many of those people actually voted for Obama, right? They voted for the fellow running for the Senate in Michigan, a black guy. All right. So, you know, I don't think you can just simply categorize them as deplorable human beings who are racist and sexist.
Well, and every now and then they may cross over also, right, and vote for some Democrats in down ballot races or other things. Yeah. Yeah.
So the question that we have asked ourselves is why? Why did Trump get 8 million more votes? And I think it speaks, and I don't know all the answers to it. I really don't. I think we'd better come up with some answers. I think, first of all, a lot of those people think that the elite in this country, including the Democratic Party, holds them in contempt, to be honest with you. All right? Hey, I work at home, and I got a computer, and I'm making $150,000 a year. You're what, just a farmer? You're going out there? You're working in a factory. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I'm going to a $300 lunch with CEOs tomorrow. What are you doing? Eating at McDonald's. I think in one way or another, that contempt comes across from the corporate media, comes across from, you know, politicians. We're superior to you all. And you know, people don't want to hear that. And then you combine that with the economic issues. If you were working in a factory for your whole life, and say you had a union, you didn't have a union, you're making 20, 30 bucks an hour. Your job went to China or Mexico, and now you're working at Walmart's for 12 bucks an hour. How do you think you feel? And your kid is going no place in a hurry. What does that make you feel? You're going in the wrong direction. And Donald Trump comes along and says, I'm going to take on the establishment. I feel your pain. Now, he's a liar and a fraud of the worst kind. But he is acknowledging that they exist.
Mm-hmm.
All right. How many national Democrats do you know end up going to Kansas or Nebraska or the rural parts of America? Think of too many. They're out in Texas. They're out in California and New York raising a lot of money. Think they're talking to farmers in Wisconsin? Maybe. I don't think so.
Yeah, I agree with you on this idea. People, you know, Donald Trump was like, for a lot of people, throwing a middle finger at the establishment, at elites in general, right? Like he was one of them. For some people, he was one of them because they also felt this powerlessness. And he was throwing a finger at that and saying, oh, you know, I'm not part of that either. And let's go shake it up.
Right? That's right. That's exactly right.
And the question is, how do we do that and at the same time be responsible and channel all of that in a positive way for people's lives, right?
No, that's exactly right. That is exactly the question. Trump is a fraud. That's all. He took on the establishment. Really? Yes. That's why he hired more billionaires to his cabinet administration than any president in history. Yeah, he took on the establishment. Really. And why he wants to throw 22 million people off the health care they have, et cetera, et cetera. But you asked the right question. And I think that gets back to me, you know, the question you asked me about what a Biden might, you know, want to be thinking about. And you know, I think you could do, you know, unlike Trump, who's a fraud, I think Biden is going to say, you know what? We are going to take on the establishment. Okay. And there are things you could do on executive order. There are things you could do, obviously, with legislation. How do you think America would feel if on day one, Biden makes a very simple statement? And he says to the pharmaceutical industry, and I got to tell you, I speak only for myself. In my view, they're crooks. They're engaged in price fixing and collusion. That's my own personal belief, okay? And charging us outrageous prices. And Biden says, within 6 months or 3 months, we will no longer be paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. We're going to cut drug costs in half. And I want every American to know that. And if the pharmaceutical industry doesn't like it, they can go to hell because we're going to deal with that. Now, how do you think the people in rural areas, Trump people and everybody else would say? They say, hey, Joe, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I missing something or not?
Yeah.
And then the pharmaceutical industry will go crazy and they'll put 30-second ads denouncing everybody. But you want to take on the establishment in a responsible way? That's what you do. What about, you know, I'm an advocate of Medicare for all. I think the current system is totally dysfunctional, wasteful, cruel. Don't get me going. But at the very least, if Joe announces first week that if you are a worker out there who's 58, 59 years of age and you're struggling with healthcare, this is what we're going to do. We're going to lower the eligibility age of Medicare from 65 down to 55. We're going to make it simpler. We're going to do away with a lot of the copayments and the deductions that you have to pay. What do you think people all over this country, in Texas and Vermont and every place else would be saying? Say, oh, wow, Joe, man, you're great. Well, but to do that, you're going to have to take on the power of the insurance companies. Joe prepared to do that? Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
If we say that by a stroke of a pen, matter of fact, through executive order, we can cancel student debt up to the first $50,000 of student debt. What do you think the young people in this country would say to Joe Biden if he did that?
They'll name colleges and universities after him, I'm sure.
Yes, they will. All right. See, those are, what I'm saying here, holding on, those are dramatic, simple acts that will resonate with the overwhelming majority of the American public. And then some of the Trump people who said, well, I hate Joe Biden. He's a legit. But you know what? He just did something for my kid. He just did something for me. Maybe I'll listen to what he has to say. Maybe the Democrats, you know, are not whatever they are, crazy, you know. Will Joe do that? We'll see. But Trump, you are absolutely right. And I like that metaphor. He gave the establishment the middle finger, but he was a fraud.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's time that we stood up to the establishment and for working people, but in an honest way, which improves their lives. What do you think about what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I'm going to put you on the spot.
I think one of the lessons that we have learned or should have learned is you got to produce results for people. You got to actually have produce results that people feel in their lives. Of course, right. Mitch McConnell obviously understands that we want to produce results, and he has been one of the most effective blocks on progress in this country. Yes. I mean, what do you see shaping up in terms of our ability to actually produce some of these results on healthcare, on education, on student loan debt, on any number of things?
Well, obviously, a lot of that has to do with what happens in Georgia with Reverend Warnock and Mr. Ossoff, who are good candidates running against, you know, real Trumpites out there. If they can win, and it's going to be a hard struggle, it will give Democrats with the vice president voting in a 50-50 Senate, she will break the tie, and we will then have control over the Senate. We'll have the chairmanships of all the committees. We can push the agenda and go forward. And when you do that, what I would do, and it's what I, you know, just indicated I thought Biden should do, is we can begin to put, obviously, if we have the majority, we can go forward, but we can put our opponents on the defensive. You know, one of the things, Julian, that has always driven me a little nuts is Democrats come up with enormously complicated proposals. And I think we need to come up with simple, straightforward proposals. Nothing complicated about saying you're going to cancel the first $50,000 of student debt. Pretty simple. Nothing complicated about saying you're going to lower Medicare eligibility to 55. Raise the minimum wage to 15 bucks an hour. Nothing complicated about it. And I think if we do not gain control over the Senate, and I certainly hope that we will, then what we got to do is take those simple issues around the country. We got to go to Kansas, and we got to go to Louisiana, and we got to say to the people, here is the bill. You tell your senator, you tell McConnell, do you want a $15 an hour minimum wage or do you not? And we've got to take simple, straightforward legislation to the people, get outside of the Beltway, and get them to say, hey, Mitch, you know, I live in Kentucky and I can't make it on 10 bucks an hour. Raise that damn minimum wage or else I'm not going to vote Republican anymore.
Well, in this election on November 3rd, even as Florida gave its 29 electoral votes by, I think, something like 3 points this time, unfortunately, to Donald Trump, the voters passed a $15 minimum wage proposal that scales up to $15 in 2026. But time after time, when that kind of proposal has been on the people's ballot, it has passed.
That's right. And I think somebody's got to analyze that. Point being that the issues that you and I fight for are popular issues.
Yeah.
And then they go out and vote Republican. Why? A lot of reasons for that. But that's what we got to be thinking about.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And we would like to invite you on a hilarious and heartfelt journey each week on The Deep Dive. From navigating the chaos of motherhood and family to exploring the depths of grief and loss, we are just two best friends who process life together and with you guys. Discover our secrets to finding joy amidst the madness and get ready for unfiltered conversations about life, love, and everything in between. and nails. We talk a lot about nails. Now, community is everything to us at The Deep Dive. We believe in the power of connection and the strength that comes from supporting one another, and we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. Bernie and I spent a lot of time discussing the future of our nation, but so far, we'd conveniently avoided talking about what was next for each of us.
You ran in 2016. You ran in 2020. 2024? What is next for Senator Bernie Sanders?
I doubt that very, very much. You know, I am going to be 50 years of age next week, and I'm getting up there, Julian, so, you know.
I'm gonna be 20, so don't worry, you know, we're both getting up there, yeah.
See, if you're not careful, I'll ask you that question.
Yeah, well, I don't have an answer either. I mean, I'm just going along. But more seriously, I mean, you've indicated a willingness to take on the role of Secretary of Labor. You know, obviously, President-elect Biden is still making his decisions on his cabinet, but just what is your interest in that role? I mean, why is it appealing to you?
Well, you know, I love being in the Senate, and if God willing, Democrats gain control over the Senate, there's enormous things that we can do. I'm on some really exciting committees that I look forward to working on. But this is what I think. You know, getting back to the point that we discussed a moment ago. Imagine having a Secretary of Labor who didn't spend all of his time or her time in Washington, D.C., but went out to Texas and told a few thousand people at a town meeting in San Antonio or Houston or someplace, Dallas, I want to hear what it's like to live on $9 an hour. Okay, I want to hear about what your experience is and tell me why you think you need to raise the minimum wage. And I want to tell you to tell me why, what happened when you tried to form a union and your employer fired you. Why do you think we need unions in America? And why do we need legislation to prevent corporations from making it hard for workers to join unions? And if you're a woman out there, tell me about why you're making 70 cents on the dollar compared to the guy who's doing the same work next to you.
Yeah.
All right. So in other words, to take these issues to the people, not just in Washington, but to talk about how people are getting ripped off with wage theft and not getting the overtime that they deserve. And God knows during this COVID, if we've seen anything, it's so many workers are forced to work in unsafe working conditions. They're dying because they don't have the protections that they need. Now imagine a secretary going out to the people, hearing the people, and saying, well, what do you think we should do in Washington? Okay, let's do it. So it's not sitting in Washington coming up with complicated ideas. It's going out to the people and making them aware that the United States government is listening to them. That's what interests me.
Wow. There are tons of young people out there who were particularly inspired by you. And in the decades to come, there are people who are going to run for president themselves and may well become president because they were originally inspired by your leadership and your runs in 2016 and 2020. What is your advice for young people in our country, those who want to go into public service and then just folks who have their dreams and want to achieve them?
Let me just say this. Thanks for asking that question. And whenever anyone asks me about that, I usually break out with a big grin and a big smile. Because honest to God, Julian, some of the most beautiful sights that I have ever seen in my life, and I say this from the bottom of my heart, is being California, elsewhere, and seeing thousands and thousands of young people out there, black and white and Latino and Asian American and Native American, you name it. And what America is, and you're seeing these beautiful young people deeply committed to the struggle for justice. It is a beautiful, beautiful sight that I will take with me to the rest of my life. One of the most beautiful and moving things I have ever seen. Touched me very, very deeply. And when I go out and I talk to young people, we did a virtual rally during the Biden campaign 2 months ago. And some young lady, where was she? She was on the city council in some small town in California that I had never heard of. And she says, I'm on the city council because you said we should run for office. And I did, and I won. And I see that we have supported hundreds and hundreds of young people, mostly young people, all colors, backgrounds, who are on school boards, they're on city councils. We've helped transform state legislatures. New York State, a very different legislature than it was. Chicago, there are 6 Democratic Socialists on the city council right now, all new. So there's a lot of movement among young people. And, you know, I hope that, and by the way, let us not minimize the role that the young people voting in this election had for Biden. There was by far the highest turnout of young people ever. And he won a number of states, Georgia certainly being one of them, precisely because of young people. So I would say to young people, don't think you cannot do it. You can do it. You can be on the city council. You can run for state legislature. Get involved. Support your friends. And if you love the country, our country, help transform it. And I think that's happening. And that's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Well, you certainly have helped to transform our country, Bernie. And thank you for speaking truth to power and for your advocacy and courage of your convictions and for continuing to lead. And thank you for taking a little time to talk.
Well, Julian, let me give a mutual thanks to you for your life's work. And then you had a few young people supporting you as well. So let's keep going together. And thank you very much for having me.
This is a moment of opportunity for our country. It's a chance to fight for transformative change without ceding ground and making deals that hurt and alienate the very people whose lives we're trying to improve. But if we want our policies to reflect the true makeup of our country, we need policymakers who represent that mission. Next time, we talk to two women doing just that on opposite sides of the country.
It's not just about growing up black. It's about growing up poor. It's about having a grandmother. It's about being spiritual. It's about caring about people. It's about understanding that we all have unique experiences, and with those challenges come opportunities for us to do better.
We'll see you back here on January 14th after the holiday break. I hope you and your family have a wonderful holiday and a happy new year. Our America is a Lemonada original. This episode was produced by Keegan Zema. Jackie Danziger is our supervising producer. Our associate producer is Julia Yort. Music is by Hannes Brown. Executive producers are Stephanie Whittleswax, Jessica Cordova Kramer, and Julian Castro. Help others find our show by leaving us a rating and writing a review. Follow us at Lemonada Media across all social platforms. Or find me on Twitter at Julian Castro, or on Instagram at Julian Castro TX.
Lemonada.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.